from the studios, Veterans Radio at Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This is Veterans Radio, and today's host is Gary Lilly.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
I did have something else to read. This program is being dedicated to the 101st Airborne. That's right. That's all I got to say.
Thank you, Bob. Well, Veterans Radio is the world's number one radio program for veterans, and my name is Gary Lilly. Welcome. This morning we're going to have a great program about the operating room nurses in Vietnam. We'll have Sandy Wilson as a guest. Welcome, Sandy. And no, it's radio. You don't nod. And so, okay, thanks. We'll be getting right back to that. Bob, let's go with the welcome homes.
Thank you, Gary. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who've been stationed around the world to service our country. But now, we're going to try something a little bit different. Gary, go ahead.
Thank you. Veterans Radio wants to welcome home every single unit, every single person that's coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, and other parts of the world. The thin green and blue line that's protecting us, and we want to welcome you home to America. back home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back with Veterans Radio. You got the moves, Bob. You're back there dancing away to that music.
Ah, how can you miss it with Jimmy Cliff? Woo! Love it.
Yeah, I do too. I love that song. This morning, we have as our guest Sandy Wilson. Sandy was the youngest operating room supervisor in any receiving hospital in Vietnam. Sandy, welcome to Veterans Radio, and tell us what precisely your job was.
I was in charge of all the activities for the operating room and also sterile supply. So basically, I took care of my people and made sure that they were able to do the job that they were supposed to do and they had the equipment to do it, and sort of taught them and soothed the doctors or straightened them out, whichever the case may be, as it was needed, to make sure that we had adequate personnel and equipment to take care of our patients, being our generation of American men and women.
You were 24 years old?
Yeah, I was 24 years old when I got there, just newly made captain.
That's pretty young age to have all of that responsibility.
Well, you have to work with what you got, and I was what they had.
You were at three different hospitals?
Yes, I was.
Tell us about them.
Well, I started out at the 8th Field Hospital in the Trang, and it was 350 beds. It had all the specialties. We had neurosurgeons assigned there so that we could handle anything that anybody else couldn't long enough to get them back stateside or back to Japan. I was also at the 36th Evacuation Hospital in Vung Tau, and it had most of the specialties. There were no neurosurgeons there, and we got a lot of wounded, and we also had their Vietnamese children's unit.
That's something that most people don't know, is that we also treated the children or the civilians over there.
Yeah, we did that. I mean, their medical care had, a lot of their physicians and nurses had taken off and gone to France or someplace like there where it was safer. And there was a real medical care crunch in that country. So in our, you know, we took care of them as much as we could. And when the doctors had their off times, they would walk through the villages and try and diagnose some diseases and stuff so they could come back and bring them to the hospital and keep their skills in tone for when they returned.
I know that we did that because they also needed armed guards, and I did that for our medical teams over when I was in Chulai.
Well, these weren't really prisoners. We also took care of the prisoners. You know, the opposing forces troops. And, you know, they would be guards, but a lot of the time we just took care of Vietnamese civilians because they needed to be taken care of. And I remember one of the most memorable and tragic events that I experienced was at the 7th Surge, when on Christmas Eve, the helicopters started coming in. Someone had thrown a white phosphorus grenade in the front of the church for Christmas Eve services. So we got 27 Vietnamese boys and one old man from that incident, and we only had 7 empty beds. So as the last helicopters came in, they were also taking the people, you know, these children that we didn't have the facilities to care for their injuries elsewhere. So the next morning we ended up with a total of 7 children in our hospital from that.
And just to clarify, that would not have been a GI that did that. The VC were, and the NVA were both practiced a lot of terrorism to try to bring the civilian population in line, not be friendly with them.
Well, this is true. It was the enemy forces that did this. And the worst part about the situation is this: their village was probably 7 miles away from us. And on Christmas morning, the families walked down there, and they were amazed at how good these kids looked that we had. And because none of the kids spoke English and everything, we had logged them in as Vietnamese 1 through 27, and on Christmas Day, we could not tell their parents where their children were.
Oh, my. What was the last hospital you were at?
36th back, the 7th Surge came in between, and it was the base camp for the 11th Armored Cav with Colonel Patton.
And, oh, really?
We basically took care of his troops, and we would get some Vietnamese in and stuff like that. But and that hospital only had a total of 11 nurses, and I was the only nurse in the operating room.
What was that camp called?
Black Horse.
Black Horse, okay. That's why I didn't say it. I can never remember the name of it. Where did it sit? What kind of territory was it? Was it back by the ocean or the sea? Or?
It was sort of in that triangle between Vung Tau, Saigon, and the coast.
Okay.
You know, it was a place that many people didn't even know existed, but Colonel Patton insisted that he have a hospital at his base camp. And every week when he came back to the base camp, he'd come check on his wounded troops.
That would have General George Patton's son?
You've got it.
Okay. Probably inherited a little bit of his dad's personality, I imagine.
I think he corrected his dad's personality.
He was
a wonderful man.
Is that right?
Yep,
okay.
We all loved him.
That's terrific. That's the first time I ever heard anybody that knew that his personality. I've often heard about him being there, but I didn't know what kind of a person he was.
Oh, yes. He was very much for the troops, and, you know, he was interested in saving lives and doing that sort of stuff. There was always an interest in his troops.
You talked about what the doctors, and did the nurses go out into the villages, too, to treat them?
We did one. I got to do one with the 11th Armored Cav, in fact. We didn't realize that they were going to give two of us a day off, and they put us on one of the 11th Cav's helicopters with flak jackets and all that sort of stuff and took us to their forward camp. And when we got there, they had us take off our flak jackets and our helmets and all the protective gear, and we were supposed to go in the village and provide treatment. But, you know, they selected us because we both had blonde hair. And this village had never seen American females before. So as the corpsmen were taking care of and providing medical help at the village, all the villagers were coming over and touching us and asking us if we were really real. So that was the extent of the medical care we provided that day.
Okay. What would happen? Would casualties come in a bit at a time or en masse or both?
Let me define first what a mass casualty is.
Okay.
You can have a mass casualty with two people.
All right.
A mass casualty is whenever the need and those coming in exceeds your capabilities for caring for them all at that time. So sometimes you might have a helicopter come in and it might have three or four wounded on it that needed life-saving treatment. And in some hospitals, we were able to take care of that. In the field hospital, we had five operating rooms. So as long as there was less than five coming in on the chopper, it was no big problem. We had the staff, we had the equipment, all that sort of stuff. Of course, there was one day that I remember the casualties didn't stop for 36 hours. And we had all of our crews out working that entire time. And the way it ended was the hospital had a party, and we got food poisoning. So they had to send the helicopters elsewhere, and the battle continued for more than 48 hours. At the seventh surge, there was myself as the operating room nurse, and there was a nurse, you know, two people for anesthesia. So it was very possible for three casualties to become a mass casualty because we could not take care of more than that, and there would be somebody waiting in line.
How did the food poisoning take place? How did it come from?
It was the macaroni salads, what they finally detected. One of the mayonnaise cans had a pinhole in it that caused the mayonnaise to be bad. So, you know, those of us who got affected that day, even today, I do not eat macaroni salad.
It was pretty bad. How many were affected?
Well, I'm not quite sure. It was more than half of the hospital personnel. I can remember being loaded in an ambulance outside the triage area, and there were about 60 people laying on the ground with IVs running and lights strung up so they could watch them because we didn't have, you know, there was so many of our own people were sick, they had to put them together.
And so those were all our own people that were?
Those were hospital workers.
60, food poisoning, dehydrated.
Yeah, you get dehydrated.
Yep, okay.
I mean, they found a solution for it. It was massive doses of atropine to dry you out and something else that was going to make you to settle your stomach. And the doctor that prescribed it gave three times the normal dose of the atropine. So we got really dried out.
You wanted you back in a hurry, I guess, huh?
Well, they didn't get us back in a hurry. It took several days for us to get back and working. But, you know, that was just one of the things that happened. Most of the time, you know, we worked and took care of the casualties because as nurses and as doctors, our sole job was to conserve the fighting strength and save as many lives as possible.
So what does that mean?
That means that even though we are young and dumb, we would try anything to make sure that soldier lived long enough to get home.
How successful were you guys? Once they reached the hospital, what was the survival rate?
96%.
96%.
Nobody else had was able to capture a survival rate like that. I mean, we set records. We set records for burn treatment. The burn centers that were started because of Vietnam were copied throughout the United States, and the same stuff that we were using then is being used now all over the world.
And it was on-the-job training that, I mean, the way that you figured out how to treat them, is that it?
It was on-the-job training, and the burn center in Japan was the first one to come up with the treatment that's used today. And there is one of the nurses was assigned there that is a friend of mine, and they told her that she had to write this up to put it in the professional journals. And the reason she was chosen is she had the correct initials behind her name.
Say that again, please.
She had a master's degree, so she had the correct educational initials behind her name.
Oh, uh-huh.
In order to get published.
Right, right.
So whether she could write or not, she had to submit this article for publication.
The types of casualties you got were not like a trauma center in the United States. What were the kinds of, for the people that are sensitive, maybe you don't want to listen to this, but what were some of the casualties that you had that were hard to deal with or did have a hard time thinking back on it?
Well, I can think back on a few of them. Burns were a big thing. I remember a soldier coming into the 36th Evac that had burns over 100% of his body. You know, there was this thing called napalm.
Yeah.
So the burns were significant, which is why we developed the burn centers and everything like that, is to take care of that unique casualty. Orthopedic injuries. We had probably six times more amputations than they did in World War II.
That's because of being able to get the wounded back quicker?
Right. That was because the helicopters got the soldiers that would have died en route into health care a lot sooner. There were all kinds of head injuries. You know, the helmets and stuff are better today than they were then. The flak jackets of today are better than we had then. So we had a lot of amputations. And are you familiar with what a basket case is?
No.
That's all four limbs are amputated. We saw some of those. We saw people with double amputees, triple amputees. And those were the people who lived. You know, our surgical hospitals over there was set up with the idea of taking care of amputees and people who had abdominal wounds. Life-saving thing till we could get them into an evacuation hospital or a field hospital or get them all the way back into Japan and into the system to get them home. And these were the things we were taking care of.
Were there ever any that you wish would die?
We did not consider that. I did not learn about death with dignity until after Vietnam. Now I might have a different attitude, but, you know, I thought if somebody didn't want to be saved sometime through my lifetime, they would tell me that. And I've never ran into any Vietnam veteran that told me that I should not have saved him.
I remember seeing something, I believe, on 60 Minutes about a doctor that was asked that question, and he said yes, and he described the soldier, triple amputee, blind, you know, head injuries and such, and he said it haunted him. He inwardly wished he'd have let him die. Got the reporters to being, you know, really curious about this. Did the guy die? He spent 2 years researching it. Then he found the guy, and he got a hold of the doctor and said that he'd found that soldier. And the guy was a father of three, and one of his favorite sports was scuba diving. And the doctor said, you know, it can't be the same guy. And he arranged a reunion for them, and quite emotional. They had it on camera. They couldn't have a dry eye watching it. So from that point, you never know what somebody has inside. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And besides that, they never told us that we were supposed to do anything other than to save the troops.
Yep.
And there were troops. You know, you have to think about it like this. The casualties came in, the average age was about 19. You can abuse a 19-year-old body a lot more than you can abuse one that's 45, which meant that these people would make it when an older person would not have. And I can remember doing open heart surgery without the machinery to do it. You know, the guy had been shot in the heart, and we actually, with just gloves on, without scrubbing or anything, the doctors went in and we helped him and they patched up this heart and we got him out of a helicopter and took him to a higher level hospital. Now, I have no idea what happened, but my good friend was the anesthesia person and she says, we didn't have the respirators on that helicopter as he was being transported, and she went with him and bagged him all the way and says, you know, it really was getting hard near the end.
What does bag mean?
You have to squeeze the bag to get oxygen in their lungs.
Like a hand pump.
A hand pump. It's your hand pumping that bag, squeezing that bag. We have no idea what happened to him. Actually, we have no idea what happened to 99.5% of the people that went through us, because we saw them. We took care of them. Probably anywhere from an hour to 4 hours later, we passed them over to the recovery room. And if we saw them again, it was a miracle. You know, most of them, if they were injured severely enough, went through the evacuation chain from us to a bigger hospital, to Japan, back to the United States. And if in the United States, they had different military hospitals set up for different type of injuries. You know, the burn center was in San Antonio. The lung center was in Denver. The orthopedic center was over in California. And until we came back and continued our time in the military, we didn't see the results of our efforts.
Have you ever met somebody that passed through your hospital at a time that you were there?
I have no idea. I've never met anybody that I could say, yes, I took care of you. And I meet a lot of people.
Yes, I know. You're very active as an advocate for veterans.
Now, some of the people, in fact, there was two of the nurses who were with me at the 7th Surgical Hospital actually married patients that they had taken care of over there.
Is that right?
Yeah, you know, and happens.
Were you there at the dedication of the Women's Memorial in Washington at the Wall?
Oh, yes, I was there, but I got caught out. I had to make a pit stop because it was so long waiting, and I could not get back inside the snow fence for the actual presentation, but I was able to see it up on the on the thing. And I was good. I stood there at the opening of the fence as people were coming out and telling them that I lost my husband. Could you help me find him? He's got on gray stuff and on green stuff, and he has a mustache. You know, I had more fun doing that.
I think everybody had on green stuff and had a mustache.
You're right, they did.
It was like a Kenny Rogers look-alike contest there.
Oh, yeah. You know, I just had more fun in getting people's reaction when I asked them that. But getting back to, you know, to Vietnam and the things that were there is the thing that, you know, the operating room and anesthesia people, we did not work the same hours as everybody else. It, you know, everybody else was around-the-clock work. And you have a choice. You have a 24-hour period. Here in the States, we have, you know, some people do 8-hour shifts, and that comes up to 24. You have people doing 12-hour shifts. Two 12s comes up to 24. Over there, initially, it was 8-hour shifts, and then they got this idea on how to take care of their staffing, so they switched it to 12-hour shifts for all the nurses on the units. And then they decided that they still didn't have enough, so they increased it to where nurses ended up working 6.5 days a week on 12-hour shifts. So basically, you got a half a day off every week. And that equals a lot of hours.
That's 78 hours.
That's what it was. And then afterwards, what do? You're pretty well confined to the compound, and you're also responsible if there was really a lot of helicopters coming in. All the nurses ran over to the triage area to see what they could do. The operating room people went to work every morning because you didn't necessarily have casualties coming in. You know, they came in whenever, but you had all these other second surgeries that had to be done, and you had the doctors going out and finding Vietnamese people to operate on. And then you went home when the day was done, and it might be 8 hours, it might be 10 hours. You might be there forever. But when everybody, when the helicopters started coming in, all the people in the operating room in anesthesia made a beeline for the operating room because we were there as long as it took to treat that wounded soldier.
Were you ever overwhelmed?
There were several times when I was overwhelmed.
Emotionally?
Emotionally, physically. You know, you just to the you point to where you say, I really can't get out of bed today. You know, I really just can't move. And when I was in Nha Trang, they called us on. We had phones in our rooms. We were on one side of the compound, and where we worked was on the other side. And they said, there's a mass casualty. You need to go to work right away. And I said, there's small arms fire outside my door. I ain't leaving yet. Wait till the small arms fire stops. Because I knew it was going to take them time if we had casualties in order to get them as far as us to pick them up. But there were, you know, lots of times that we were working late at night. They would have the compound blacked out. And in Vung Tau with the 3060 back, the medical officer's housing area was 7 clicks away from the hospital.
7 kilometers.
Yes. Which meant that you had to be transported to the hospital. We did have one nurse that would stay at the hospital and sleep on a cot all night. But if they needed more help, they would call, they would wake up this major. And if it was a lieutenant on, she needed 2 people, and she would get dressed and get her in her Jeep, and on the way out the door, tell the guard to wake me up. And I would have to get up and get dressed and find a way to the hospital, which meant I had to talk somebody who had a Jeep to take me in there. If she was the person at the hospital, she would only need 1 extra team, and she would tell him to get me. And several years ago, I ran into her, and I asked her why she did that, and she says, well, I knew you'd be the only one sober.
You know, you didn't drink back then either, huh?
Yeah, I did. She didn't know how much I was drinking. At that point, I was pretty well disgusted with everything, and the bar was right outside the officer's quarters. So, because most of the nurses were women, the Air Force officers were over there, the Navy officers were over there, they were forcing drinks upon you. There were times that I would have 10 drinks in front of me. You know, that was just. And then, you know, the next day I'd go to work and feeling really bad, and I'd say, I'm not drinking today. And I'd start over at the club with lemonade without sugar. And then some people would come by and they would start buying drinks. And the next day I would again promise that I was not going to drink again.
I remember those days quite well. You know, I'm not. We've got about 45 seconds left. You're listening to Veterans Radio, coming to you from WDEO Radio, our flagship station on the Ave Maria Radio Network. We're talking to Sandy Wilson, who is the youngest operating room supervisor in Vietnam.
Yes.
Okay. When we get back, we're going to talk a little bit about those bad casualty days. And you can get a little graphic if you would. And the reason why I say that, there's a lot of people that don't have a clue as to what this is all about, what took place. And I want them to really hear it, whether it's uncomfortable for them or not. Listening to Veterans Radio, we'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Lance Corporal Roy Wheat threw himself on an anti-personnel mine to save his fellow Marines. Details after this.
You have your boots on, you're wet, you're cold. You feel like it's the land that time forgot. Drill instructors all over the place, they're like lying. And you ask yourself, my God, what did I get myself into? Your body's screaming, but your mind and your heart tells you, keep on going. Don't give up. You question yourself, do I have what it takes to become a United States Marine? In the back of my mind, I knew I was not going to quit on myself. And when you stand there on the parade deck, and that drill instructor comes in front of you, the one that made you better, holds out his hand, shakes your hand, and they call you brother, call you Marine, you break down in tears.
Private Ramon Hernandez became a United States Marine. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
Wheat and two other Marines were assigned the mission of providing security for a Navy construction battalion crane and crew operating along Liberty Road in the Quang province. After the Marines had set up security positions in a tree line adjacent to the work site, Wheat reconnoitered the area to the rear of their location for the possible presence of guerrillas. He then returned to within 10 feet of their friendly position and here, unintentionally, triggered a well-concealed bounding-type anti-personnel mine. Immediately, a hissing sound was heard, which was identified by the three Marines as that of a burning time fuse. Shouting a warning to his comrades, Wheat, in a valiant act of heroism, hurled himself upon the mine, absorbing the tremendous impact of the explosion with his body.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother,
there's far too many of you dying. You know we find.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking to Sandy Wilson, the youngest.
That is such a long bump. You know, I wanted to get the what's going on. You got it?
It's
a long bump.
We could do that. Anyway, next time. Sandy, where were you born? Where are you from?
I'm from Michigan.
Really? What part?
The suburbs in Detroit.
Okay. Where did you go to school?
In Louisville, Kentucky.
Your college was at Louisville, Kentucky?
Well, I went to Louisville, Kentucky, and after Vietnam, I came back home, and I went to Wayne State University. And then for a while, I went to the University of Michigan.
That was your medical school in Louisville?
Right.
Okay.
It was a unique place in that it was one of the premier schools of nursing in the country at the time.
And what caused you to go in the military after school?
Well, one of the things that's in the organizational plan and the supply plan for the military is it dictates what type of personnel you have. And their needs for operating room nurses far exceeded their ability to get them. And they knew I was an operating room nurse, so it took them a year and a half to finally get me in because I was negotiating with them.
What do you negotiate with the military?
You negotiate what rank you're going in at.
Okay, and you went in as?
A first lieutenant.
Okay, you skipped right over the second lieutenant.
Well, I had the experience outside in order to be able to do that. It just took a while to convince them that I had that. And I also I also negotiated the factor that they would send me to operating room nursing school.
Okay, and were you working in the meantime after school and negotiating with the Army?
Oh, yes, I was working in an operating room.
Okay. And what caused you to think, I want to go in the military?
My brother was an Army officer who ended up spending over a year in a military hospital because of an accident here in the States. And we were very close, and he kept saying, "Sis, you will really like this."
Did he know about Vietnam at the time?
I don't think he even considered Vietnam. And when they were recruiting me, they told me only the brightest and the best were volunteering for Vietnam. And I assumed that excluded me.
What did you get orders or did you volunteer for Vietnam?
I would never volunteer for something like that. I mean, it's bad enough if you're in a situation and you're working your little butt off. But to have to admit to yourself that you volunteered for that, you know, it's better if you just go because they tell you to rather than volunteer for it.
We've got a caller in from New Jersey. Steve? Ah, there you go. Steve, New Jersey. Good morning.
Good morning. Sandy, I probably passed through your hands in Bungtel in 69. I was stationed at 23rd Engineers Port Construction, and I contracted hepatitis B over there. Turned yellow, and they sent me right up to 36 evac, and from there I went to Long Bend, and you were talking about the burn ward in Japan, and I saw it.
Yes, and you know how difficult it was for us to take care of those folks and make sure that they got home.
Ma'am, I can't imagine. But God bless you.
Thank you, Steve. Emotional all right. After all of these years.
Yes.
Well, Steve, thanks for calling in. I know it's hard for you to talk right now. Was there anything else you wanted to say? Or
Just thank God for people like her.
It's a funny
thing. You saved a lot of lives, man. You just don't know.
Well, you know, we never knew for sure what happened, but at the same time, most of us came back without a scratch because there were people out there making sure that we were safe.
Well, I think the worst experience I had was when they put me on the plane to Japan, and I'm laying there with all my extremities and laying alongside of men that were incomplete. And then when I got to Japan, I saw more of it. And I can't imagine dealing with it the way you did firsthand.
Yeah, not because Sandy's sitting here, but every time we meet veterans and there's conferences or just conversations going on, they all talk about the nurses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're the best.
Probably the doctors that saved the... I don't mean it that way. But the doctors hardly ever get mentioned, and I guess that's probably because of the fact that the nurses were the ones that the guys had the most contact with.
Definitely.
And they never got the credit.
Not enough, that's for sure. Not enough.
I have to hang up. I can't talk anymore. I'm sorry.
Thanks for calling in, Steve.
I
appreciate your emotions, and it's very much appreciated that you got the chance to say this to Sandy and all the nurses.
Thank you, ma'am.
You know, part of the things that we did over there is there was always a shortage. And our government decided that they would make up for these shortages by training people. Many of the doctors you saw over there had not completed a residency. They had completed half of it, and then they got called up, and it was like on-the-job training for them. Most of the surgical technicians that we had completed 8 weeks of training, 8 weeks of on-the-job training, and then they were in Vietnam.
How did they prepare you during that period of time?
Well, all of us, the doctors and the nurses, did our basic at Fort Sam Houston, Texas.
Okay.
And we used to laugh at the doctors. They used to tell them things like, people with chickens on their shoulder have to do with the mess hall. You know, that's a full colonel.
Uh-huh.
And they would tell them how to wear a uniform. And then they would take us, the nurses and the doctors, over to the labs. They wanted to make sure that we knew how to do the necessary things. So they used goats. and we all got to do a tracheotomy on a goat. And the reason the goat was selected is it has lots of spots on its long neck to do trachs. You could do more than one on a goat. And then we learned how to debride wounds. And, you know, I thought this was sort of strange because this is not something nurses do in the United States. But in Vietnam, when those people came in and they had shrapnel wounds on all their limbs and everything, the surgeon would look at me and says, which limb do you want to work on? And then we had our OR technicians, when they went to sew them up, frequently we would have them sewing them up that 5 days later when we did it, because we didn't have time to get to it. And, you know, if you're a veteran from Vietnam and you got bad scars, I will take the blame for some of them.
When the debris, what was the term you used?
Debridement. That's when you cut out all the dead tissue or tissue that you think is going to die so it doesn't get infected.
And that would come from raggedy shrapnel wounds and such?
It would come from shrapnel wounds, from dirt, you know, all of those types of things. We did not close wounds in Vietnam unless they were wounds that exposed the inside of the abdomen or exposed a bone or something like that. And many times we didn't even close them when they exposed a bone because you had to take them back 4 to 5 days later and make sure you got all the dead tissue because tissue would continue to die if you didn't get it out. And finally we would go ahead and we would let the wound heal from the bottom up, which causes really bad scars, but it saves tissue in the long run. And that was one of the techniques that was learned in Vietnam.
You know, I'm sitting here just listening to you and picturing it in my mind and everything, and it's hard to even ask a question. What was the thing that you did that would have only been considered done by a doctor back here in the States? If the doctors had... What was the priority? Head wounds? Heart?
A priority was probably abdomens or yeah, there was really no priority.
Okay.
Everything was a priority. What, you know, we treated the ones that we had the capacity to treat, and those that you thought it was sort of shaky whether they would make it or not, when you got through treating everybody else and they were still breathing, you went ahead and did them too.
The triage is when you...
You separate out and decide which order they're going to come to the operating room. And I was in charge of the schedule for the operating room.
So you did the triage?
I went over and I set the schedule for in which order we could take them to the operating room.
Oh, okay.
Considering the resources we had. And, you know, if you had only one room that could open somebody's head, if you've got somebody in it, you can't do the next one until you get that one all done.
Would anybody be left a nurse with the ones that were waiting?
Oh, yeah. The nurses that normally work triage would be over there with them.
Okay. What would be the most stressful job as a nurse over there?
You know, I don't know. They were all stressful. And it depended upon the individual and how they reacted. I remember this one day we were at the 3060 back in the operating room there. It didn't have dividing walls between the operating room tables. And we were doing an amputation and there was a nurse scrubbed in. No, she was circulating and I was scrubbed in. And I turned around and handed her this leg that she was not expecting, and she just lost it right there.
We're talking about the nurses in Vietnam. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
LBJ, it says this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very clear, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please.
And we remember Lyndon Johnson really well, don't we? This is for Steve in New Jersey, who phoned in. Sandy and I were just sitting here talking about it, and I said, you know, Sandy, this is great you being on, because Steve has been probably waiting 40 years to thank a nurse, and this gave him the opportunity.
I'll tell you, man, that was an incredible Veterans Radio moment. That was incredible. I want to let folks know that just happened. That's Larry King stuff, folks.
Yep. And there's a lot of veterans out there that would love to be able to thank the nurses, and hopefully they're doing it inside right now.
Well, they can go to our website, www.veteransradio.net, and send us an email. We'll pass it on. How about that?
That would be great, yes. Who would they address it to? Gary, Bob, Dale?
I think this should be to you, Gary.
Okay, Gary@veteransradio.net. Bob is our air boss today, and so he gives the orders.
Oh, yeah. And I'd also like to bring here our intern, Kai.
Hello, how's it going?
Yeah, who do you want to say hello to, real quick? Your wife.
My wife, Catherine, and my kids.
All right.
And all the veterans.
Back to you, Gary.
Thank you very much. Kai, it's really great to have you back there. It's a comforting feeling.
It's great
feeling
to be here, too.
Thank you so much. When you guys got MASH casualties, you said you went for as long as 36 hours?
Or more.
The first 24 hours was a grind. How did you get through the rest of the time?
Well, you try and figure out. You should have a little bit more personnel than you do have space for them to work. So you try and figure out how to space it out and give somebody a break. I mean, there were times that I saw people sleeping in the lounge for, you know, one of those power naps, 30-minute power nap, or they'd be sleeping under the table or just passed out under the table because they couldn't go anymore. And yet you can run around and find people to start that next one, to get it going to where, you know, you're not really compromising that wounded soldier. And you have to think about in terms of what was the need and everything. I had checked the records. The 36th Evacuation Hospital had a capacity for 250 patients. But during the 2 weeks that included TET, they admitted 400 patients a day.
400 a day.
They took in 400 casualties a day, which meant that, you know, you had to make room for the next one. So as you try and get over that first flux and everything, you have the Air Force coming in and picking up folks and transporting them to Japan, to the hospitals there, just to make room for that influx that you know is coming in right after them.
Were you there during TET?
No, I was there after TET.
You were there after
TET. I was just looking at their records and stuff like that.
It's no wonder that all the troops, everybody just has, you know, the heroes are the nurses and the doctors, you know, of course the doctors, although, as I said, everybody always says the nurses because that's who they had contact with, and then the doctors are added on. We have a doctor in our Vietnam Veterans of America chapter, Rule Long. And Rule talked about the time they had 6 days of operating, and in the last day or so, he couldn't feel his feet, couldn't feel his legs. And that's a lot of casualties.
Yes, and we were there to take care of them and hope that more would not come. But you have to understand, our objective, our mission that we were told was to save troops. And they were our generation. They were the guy next door. They were the guy you went to high school with. You just couldn't give up. You just had to keep trying and trying, because life to us as Americans was the most precious thing we had. Even though it may have, our political leaders may not have thought that as they figured out how many we can lose, every soldier that was in that combat area was extremely special to those of us that served.
And that's the attitude of the nurses and the doctors and the ones that took care of the troops that were out there. And you didn't have to be out there doing the fighting. There was mines and the convoy duties and and probably a share of accidents. And the guys, there was a lot of construction going on over there. I was just amazed one time standing on a place called Hill 35 outside of Chulai, at looking out over everything that was going on. It was astounding to me, and the LSTs pulling in and the offloading the equipment and the materials and the ammunition and the lumber. I just, who the heck organizes this? But it was like a small city being built right before my eyes, and it was just astounding. And when you've got so much going on, there's always going to be accidents, and there's always going to be casualties that are non-combat casualties. So it wasn't just the combat casualties that you got, although probably the majority of them were, by far. And
well,
go ahead.
Well, I think that in addition to the casualties, you have the sicknesses. I mean, you have, when you place our troops in another part of the world that is strange to them, you had to look at what were they going to pick up in this tropical air halfway around the world. There was the malaria, and there was like three kinds of malaria. There was the dungy fever. There was the two-step snake. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it bit you, you took two steps, and you were dead.
Right.
There was all of those medical things, and in fact, admissions to the hospital, about 40 to 50% of those were medical admissions.
You brought up the thing about snakes, which were... There were a lot of there were snake bites. There was only one known grunt out in the field documented that was killed by a snake, and the guy was hit by a cobra during a firefight. But did you get snake bites in there to treat?
Yes, we did. And they had told the troops, if somebody is bitten by a snake, bring the snake with you, because apparently the anti-venom is not the same for all snakes.
I read autobiography of one of the founders of the National Liberation Front, the Viet Cong, and he was talking about their casualties. They lost 300,000 troops on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, 100,000 of them by snake bite. So it wasn't like there was the odd occasional snake,
they were very rampant around there.
Oh, yeah. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk, because you're representing a whole bunch of nurses right now?
Well, I think the nurses certainly want to thank the troops. We learned how to hitchhike over there. There was never a military vehicle that came by with an American soldier that passed us up. I also want to thank the Navy folks that were out there in their patrol boats. I learned to swim. I realized I could swim in salt water. Of course, I was rather dumb of us to swim out to the boats and go on patrol with the guys, but we certainly appreciated the Navy guys.
Their hospital ship was offshore. When we'd get up in the morning, we'd look out there and see that white ship. It was just kind of you just drooped because you knew that an operation was about to begin, and then all day long, the Hueys just flying like they had it right to the floor, heading for those hospital ships. just, it was a sobering, sobering thing, and it would go on all day. Sometimes it went on for days. Sandy Wilson, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to be with you, Gary.
You know, Sandy, you were saving your boys back then, and you're still saving them because you are such an activist for veterans and veterans' health care and that. And from that standpoint, I want to be able to thank you. I know how hard you work at it. And there's few people that I've met that work as hard for the veterans as you do. So thank you. Well, today's program was produced by me, Gary Lilly, and the technical director was Bob Gould.
Oh, that's the air boss, baby, the air technical. No, I'm not technical. I couldn't be technical in 1,000 years. But I'd also like to introduce, again, once again, my man sitting next to me. He was quite the guy today. So, Kai, once again, why don't you say a little something?
Hello, everybody. It's good to be here.
Good. Okay, Gary, back to you.
All right. Thank you so much. Now, tune in again next week for another program about our military, about Veterans Radio, bringing the stories. And today's was quite an amazing one about people that have never been covered enough, and that's the nurses. And so until next week, from Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.
All the views and opinions on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is an LLC.